Chapter 8.
Limited time and resources.
Laurent.
The first key date we set once the Pegasus project was up and running was in early March 2021. The plan was for Forbidden Stories and the Security Lab teams to meet in person in Paris with a small group of reporters and editors from each of our four partners. Until then, everybody was working independently. Claudio and Danica had constructed a system of security protocols that allowed everybody on the project to safely access the platform that the two tech experts had created to sort and organize the tens of thousands of phone numbers on the list. The platform categorized the data by NSO client country and then ordered it by the date of selection for targeting. The database was being updated daily, because every day a new set of phone numbers was being matched to actual mobile phone owners. Matched to actual names. Those matches were happening at remarkable speed by the beginning of February, because Claudio and Danica were running their own automated caller ID operation out of the security lab. They had begun the process with apps that offered what amounted to international digital phone books. The best and most comprehensive was Truecaller, which had more than 200 million users worldwide. That enormous client base was what made Truecaller the best and most comprehensive phone directory, because whenever a mobile phone user downloaded its app, Truecaller automatically scraped the entire contents of the new user's contacts file and added it to the database. If each of those users had 50, or hundreds, or maybe even thousands of contacts, well, the numbers grew pretty fast. But that also meant Claudio and Danica had to take precautions to make sure their contacts didn't get scraped and added to the public database. They set up an account on an anonymous phone, successfully downloaded the Truecaller code from an Android app, then extracted it so they could see exactly how the app's communications portal interacted with the Truecaller server. Then they reverse engineered the code and used what they learned to write their own Python script that could crawl the Truecaller database in a privacy-preserving way over Tor, or a virtual private network. It took Danica a few long days to perfect the new tool and to make sure there would be no data or privacy leaks. But even then, he was rate-limited when performing searches, so the crawler was only able to make about 60 matches a day in the beginning. That was fine when the project was confined to Forbidden Stories, and the early crawls did turn up a lot of interesting people, like more members of the Macron government in France, and a son of Turkish President Erdogan. Danica remembers the process could be addictive. He'd come in every day wondering what grim new surprise had been revealed in the 24-hour-a-day digital treasure hunt. By the time our other four reporting partners started in earnest in February 2021, and they were suddenly new mouths to feed, Claudio and Danica had an even more efficient system in place. They had dedicated 20 different anonymous phones to the enterprise and had registered a new Truecaller account for each, which meant they might turn up 1,200 new matches in a day. They were putting a lot of names and identities and faces to the numbers on the list. The partners were making the next step of trying to get multiple sources to verify the names and numbers already matched, or doing preliminary research on those people now identified as possible targets of Pegasus spyware, or looking for patterns in the data. In our own offices at Forbidden Stories, Sandrine had divided up the work by client country and handed out assignments. Paloma was focused on Mexico. She had been able to work through only about a quarter of the more than 15,000 Mexican numbers so far, but had already identified on the list an array of people around the current president. There were more than 20 journalists already identified from every major news outlet in Mexico, and Paloma was working hard to find the numbers for every journalist who had been killed in the country in the previous few years. She was especially trying to find the number of Cecilio Pineda, a reporter whose murder we had been investigating since 2017 at the founding of Forbidden Stories. Phineas Ruckert's old-school paper notebook, meanwhile, was filling up with names of journalists targeted by an NSO client, or clients, in India. He had verified the numbers of reporters from the Hindustan Times, the Hindu, and the investigative magazine Tahelka. There were four from The Wire alone, including two of the website's four founders. Phineas had also become interested in the list of numbers selected by end users in Hungary. Hungary was not among the countries already identified in the media as a client of NSO, but hundreds of numbers appearing in the data traced back to Budapest. Phineas had already been able to identify from his own contact files the mobile phone of an investigative reporter in Hungary who had been doing work critical of the right-wing, anti-immigrant Prime Minister Viktor Orban. Audrey was working on Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states. This also drew her to Turkey. We had already noticed some really interesting anomalies in the data around the time Jamal Khashoggi was assassinated in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Claudio had seen evidence suggesting that the Turkish government was blocking URL addresses related to the Pegasus spyware. They had blocked all the Pegasus domains that Amnesty International had published in previous reports. More interesting, the Turkish block list now included new Pegasus domains that had not yet been published, suggesting that Turkish cybersecurity experts were themselves spotting new cases of Pegasus infections. Cecile had two of the most intriguing countries, including another newly identified Pegasus client, Azerbaijan. Khadija Ismailova was one of the first people in the data we had identified, but Cecile was cataloging multiple instances of people connected to Khadija being selected for targeting, including her personal attorney. Cecile was also investigating the targets selected by the Moroccan client, which appeared to be the most prolific Pegasus user after Mexico. The team from Le Monde was very interested in the Moroccan-related data set as well, because it appeared that somebody in Morocco had selected President Emmanuel Macron, as well as almost every key minister in the Macron administration. The digital reporter from Le Monde had been lining up the chronology and finding clusters of selections made at virtually the same time. The timing could possibly be related to the Moroccan government's attempts to steamroll an independence movement in Western Sahara, or to the rising public protests threatening the Algerian president. But these patterns were, like many others, just beginning to be observable in the data. They suggested places to start the reporting, places to go to confirm the targeting of the selected phones with the security lab's cyber surveillance tool, places to poke and prod for a real and publishable story, and to understand the context of the story. That's where we were in early March 2021, the first time the project partners were all in the same room together at the opening session of a 3-day symposium in Le Mans' new but chilly amphitheater. The 24 men and women invited into the meeting were all masked and had taken care to arrange themselves at safe distances in the stadium seating rising from the dais. There was a 6 p.m. curfew in Paris at that point due to increasing COVID case numbers, so a lot of the morning chatter was about where and how people could access food for dinner in the evenings. The curfew also meant we would have to break early every day, so these sessions had to be brisk and efficient. Before we started the formal meeting, people from our Forbidden Stories staff walked up the aisles, gathered every cell phone and non-project dedicated laptops, put them in a big plastic crate, and stored them in another room. Everybody there was a reporter or an editor, except for Claudio and Danica, who had come in from Berlin. They were there, among other reasons, to reiterate and update the security protocols each of the partners would have to adhere to when accessing the data or communicating with one another. I knew we could count on Claudio and Danica to be direct with us and with anybody else who had been given the privilege of accessing the leaked data. Any single mistake could be the one to sink the project. One shortcut, for the sake of convenience, could risk the entire enterprise, not to mention the safety of the source. I opened the meeting by defining the journalistic imperatives of this investigation into NSO Group and its Pegasus spyware. The data was not our story, I reminded everybody. The leak was not our headline. We had been handed a remarkable trove of information, yes, but it meant nothing until we did our work. The next 3 days, we would decide together what exactly we needed to achieve before we could publish, to discuss the stories that were beginning to surface from the database, and to discuss which might be the most powerful and the most gettable. We had to consider the best time to invite in the wider circle of media partners, and to make some determinations about how to divvy up the reporting tasks so that we didn't end up with 10 different investigators on one story strand, with other strands left wanting. Maybe toughest of all, we had to agree on a schedule. "You've seen the records," Sandrine said when she took the microphone and laid out our preferred timing. You've seen the data. We could be digging into those records for 8 years, or 10. But we have to make hard choices for security reasons. She reiterated a point she had been making to each of our partners separately. We wanted to publish the investigation in June. I could sense skepticism in the room about moving that fast. I was skeptical myself. But Sandrine didn't pause long enough for anybody to voice a doubt. We can't risk exposing the project too long, she said. We need to limit the risk. The more we wait, the more the data becomes obsolete. The data we have is up to December 2020. And remember, there are other journalists already working on NSO. If we establish a plan and start working right after the meeting, this is totally doable. Sandrine spoke a bit about how to access and read the data and how to update it for the entire group to see. Phineas pointed out that it was important to use uniform terminology. When we say a phone number is verified, he explained, that means we have not only identified the owner through a caller ID service, but we have double-checked that fact with at least one other source. And that was only the start. The crucial step was gathering forensic evidence. Using the security lab's analytical tool that showed a phone was either targeted or infected with Pegasus. When that was accomplished, we could mark the number confirmed. Only at that point did we have a possible subject for a story we might be able to publish. The math was not in our favor at that point. We had cross-checked about 30 phone numbers in the data with Pegasus victims of the WhatsApp exploit, revealed as part of a lawsuit in the U.S. in 2019, as well as 11 other victims that Citizen Lab had identified in previous reports. In terms of our own forensics, counting Jorge and all the victims Claudio and Danica had turned up in previous security lab analyses, we had confirmed an actual Pegasus targeting or infection on exactly 3 of the 50,000 or so numbers in the data. Everybody had a chance to present what they had already been working on. Our team went first. Phineas talked about what he was learning in India and in Hungary. Paloma updated the group on the latest from Mexico. She had just days earlier verified that one of the numbers in the data belonged to Cecilio Pineda, the 39-year-old journalist whose 2017 murder in Guerrero remained unsolved. His phone number first appeared in the data 2 months before he was killed, and again just 2 weeks before his death. Paloma had already called a reporter friend in Mexico and got contact information for Cecilio's wife, who was the best hope for doing the necessary forensics. It will be hard, Paloma told the group, but there is a small chance that she has the phone. Bastian Obermeier and his partner from Süddeutsche Zeitung, Frederick Obermeier, were eager to get going on possible stories in Hungary and Azerbaijan. Dana Priest from the Washington Post wanted to know more about the horrific stories of journalists being persecuted and imprisoned in Morocco. And she also thought she might have contacts in Turkey who could help with the Saudi piece of the story. That was a story of particular interest for her newspaper. Jamal Khashoggi, murdered and dismembered in the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, had been a contributor to the Post's Global Opinions section. Le Monde had their hands full with Morocco and France, and everybody wanted to discuss how we might get a former NSO employee on the record to talk about what happened inside the company. Sandrine mentioned that we had been auditing Glassdoor, where people could write reviews of the companies where they did or still do work. There are not too many negative against NSO, Cecile pointed out. A lot were anonymous. There was one who just listed his function, and I don't know if there is a way to ID them. But there are for sure some former employees out there, and I know Haaretz is in touch with former employees. Everybody's ears pricked up a bit at the mention of Haaretz, a decidedly left-wing Israeli newspaper, but one of the most respected and most read newspapers in the country, as well as the oldest still in print. Haaretz reporters had already done a good bit of work on NSO in particular and the cyber industry in general. We all agreed that the Israeli newspaper should be approached as a possible partner in the second phase of the Pegasus project, but it would have to be done cautiously. Kai Berman of Die Zeit made one of the most intriguing presentations of the symposium. Kai is one of the few journalists to have conducted an on-the-record interview with the CEO of NSO Group. I think Shalev Julio agreed to meet us because they were getting a lot of fire at that moment and he hoped to get a positive report, Kai told us of his May 2020 interview. He then explained how he had been invited to Tel Aviv to meet with Shalev in a room in the company's PR firm. Kai's request to see the NSO offices was quickly denied, but he found Shalev relaxed and surprisingly open. Among the things the NSO founder told Kai that day was that the company not only did its due diligence, as required by the Israeli Ministry of Defense, before they licensed Pegasus to any client, but they had the ability to find out exactly whom their clients were targeting. Kai knew at the time that this was an extraordinary and novel admission for NSO's head man to make. Shalev had plenty of opportunity to walk back that statement, both that day in Tel Aviv and later. The ground rules for the interview were what Kai called the German way. Before the story went to press, Kai explained, Die Zeit sent to the interview material they had chosen to publish to Shalev and NSO so they could sign off on the accuracy. We sent all the quotes 3 weeks before publication and asked if it was okay to use them. They said, we'll get back to you. They didn't. 3 days before publication, we asked again, can we use them? We'll get back to you. Never got an answer. So we published. Because of a tech error, the English version was not published at the same time as the German version. But when the English version finally published, they panicked. NSO called every day, 24/7 for 3 days. They kept saying, you're hurting us. It came down to one statement, that they can see the targets. Kai knew exactly what Shalev had said. He had all the tapes from the interview, but Die Zeit did agree to publish an addendum to the story which Kai had passed around for everyone in our group to see. The company, NSO, requested a clarification to note that it is only able to view the target of a surveillance operation if an internal investigation into that operation is launched. Otherwise, it is not possible to see who the state purchasers of the Pegasus program are targeting for surveillance. Kai's final takeaway of the experience with Shalev Hulil was really insightful. Shalev is a confident guy, he told us. Easy to like, but hard to read. Kai pointed out one of the things Shalev told him about the genius of NSO. Without mentioning countries, I can tell you that everybody would hug us. We are probably one of the best companies in the world because in the last 10 years, hundreds of thousands of people were saved because of NSO technology. Shalev, as Kai saw it, gave the impression of believing in what he says and what he is doing. Whether it was an act or sincere, Kai wasn't sure. In the end, he said, we needed to be cautious. For all his charm and all his confidence, Shalev Hulio was a very slippery figure. I tried to fact-check the things he said, Kai concluded. And he was not absolutely correct on any point. By the end of the 3 days, there was a galaxy of sparkle with possible stories, and not a single one we were ready to publish. Until we had solid confirmation that a phone on our list had been targeted by Pegasus or actually infected, we had nothing. Everything depended on getting that evidence. The idea is to start running some forensics, Sandrine told the group. See what can be done in the next 3 weeks. We have to do as much as we can without taking any risk within 3 weeks. She explained that our team at Forbidden Stories had already reached out to trusted contacts in India and Mexico to get other journalists to agree to let us do forensic analysis of their phones. But India was slow going so far, and Mexico presented a difficulty because so many of the targets used Android phones. The security lab's tool hadn't yet been able to detect traces of Pegasus infection on Androids because their backups don't save as much data as on iPhones. We also hoped to do the forensics on Khadija Ismailova's phone right away. But we had to admit that our recent attempt at forensics on the mobile phone of another Azeri journalist who was in the data was cause for concern and for enhanced caution. The journalist's phone, along with his brother's computer, had mysteriously disappeared from their hotel just hours before a Forbidden Stories team member was supposed to meet them. Bastian and Frederick said they were still willing to go to Budapest to ask a few of the targeted Hungarian reporters to submit their phones for analysis. Others in the group brought up the possibility of approaching journalists selected by Moroccans. Saudi Arabia was tough, we all agreed, but crucial. There was no way to safely get inside Saudi Arabia, but the diaspora of Saudi dissidents and journalists now in London and Toronto and Istanbul might afford us opportunities to do forensics. Claudio Guarnieri remained poker-faced, as always, throughout these discussions. There were times in the meeting, he admitted, when he was really optimistic. More than anybody else sitting in that amphitheater in Paris, I suspected, Claudio wanted this project to be successful. He had been hunting the purveyors trading in cyber surveillance malware for a lot longer than the rest of us. But there were also times when the discussion spiraled off in unexpected new directions that I sensed our lead forensic specialist was not altogether sanguine. He didn't need more on his already full plate. The data, the list, the project, and the forensic tool itself were tightly held secrets even inside his organization. There were only three people at Amnesty International's security lab who were read into the Pegasus project. Claudio, Danica, and Dana Ingleton. Only two of them were capable of doing the forensics or understood what it required. Conducting and writing up a comprehensive analysis on a single case, Claudio and Danica knew, could eat up a lot of man hours. In a decade of conducting serious research on spyware, Claudio had run successful forensics on 2, 3, maybe 4 cell phones a year, he later told me. 5, if it was a prolific year. There, in that amphitheater in Paris, it must have sounded to him like we were asking the security lab to do 5 cases every few days, for days on end. At one point in the meeting, when the group was tossing out new candidates for a forensic analysis, Claudio did ask for the microphone. I don't want to be an annoying commentator, he said, but I would try to remind you that we have limited time and resources. His other real concern, his biggest concern, Claudio kept to himself. He doesn't lack for self-confidence, but he is an empiricist at his core. At that point, the beginning of March 2021, he simply hadn't yet seen enough to convince him that the tool would deliver what we needed. Claudio Guarnieri and Danica O'Carroll understood they still had a long way to go on a road the two of them had been traveling for a very long time.